Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 321.
This week on the podcast, domestic terrorism has had a big week.
And after 12 hours of debates, we still can't pick the generic white moderates out of a lineup.
The people of Puerto Rico overthrew their government last week. Now if only we could overthrow ours.
Trump unsurprisingly can't find a national intelligence director or an intelligent person to work for him in general.
Plus, Trump is furious that Elijah Cummings can't stop Trump's own family from slumming up Baltimore.
And hey, go and demand some impeachment, people.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
That's right.
We're back.
Here we are.
We promised we would come back sometime, and it was weeks later than we expected to.
That's fine. But we bring you good news.
That's right. The reason that we took a longer hiatus than anticipated is because I flew at the last minute to DC for the House signing of the VCF bill.
Yeah.
And then, while I was there, heard that the Senate was planning, theoretically, to vote for it before their August recess.
Yeah.
And they did. And it passed.
So you
and the president has signed it, and it's law.
Yeah.
So we did it.
Yeah.
And
you had some more photo ops.
I had some more photo ops.
Television appearances.
Made some comments to various
that
reporters.
That picture of you at the signing is really
epic.
Something special.
Yeah. So I decided not to attend the White House signing for reasons that I don't think any of our listeners will be surprised to hear. But I did get invited to the House, did sort of a ceremonial signing. I think maybe knowing that some of them would not get invited to the White House signing either. And so they don't do this, I don't think, for every bill, but they did a signing with Nancy Pelosi where like a bunch of members of the New York delegation
were
there.
Allowed Carolyn Maloney another opportunity to
wear her jacket.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It allowed Peter King was the only Republican there,
right.
And it allowed them to make a good-hearted joke about
that. And it allowed
you
to be basically the only non-congressperson there.
It was, first of all, so there were two things that worked to my advantage. I wouldn't say advantage, but worked to make this moment happen. The first was that it all got organized at like midnight the night before, and I happened to be catching a train that was later out of town, and so I got this email that was like, Nancy Pelosi's having a signing, and I was like, yeah, okay, I'll go. And apparently the only other people that got that message were like a few assorted like fire and police officer union types,
yeah.
Who had, you know, who are the kind of people that show up for photo ops,
right,
when a bill has been signed, and potentially, you know, I'm sure their unions did some calls or whatever about
probably.
This, but they were people that I had not met before.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like John Feel wasn't there, John Stewart wasn't there, like everyone else had left town.
Yeah.
I think John Feel got invited, but he was sick that day. So there weren't a lot of like the main, you know, his whole team wasn't there.
Sure.
And usually they outnumber me by a vast number. And then on top of that, everyone else who got invited who wasn't a Congress member was very tall. And so they were put in the back of the photo op. But
oh, yeah.
I, as a short
there
person,
right
was
next to the
put
table.
Right there in the front. So because of the angle that the signing photos got taken at, it
right.
looks like I'm the only person there
yeah,
that's not
like
a member
you,
of Congress.
Chuck Schumer, Carolyn Maloney,
Peter King. And then, like, you know, Grace Meng and Max Rose were there. Antonio Delgado was there. Like, a few other members
yeah.
of the New York delegation were there. But, like, it's just us,
yeah.
you know, hanging out at a
yeah.
table together with Nancy Pelosi.
Mm-hmm.
But it's good. I got one of the pens that she used to sign it. Do you know how they sign these letters? Sign these bills? I had no idea the signing
just,
ritual
is her
situation.
Signature as gigantic as Trump's is, where he has those things.
No,
and
it also doesn't
up,
look
like
a 5-year-old wrote it. But what it does have is the look of a signature that was traced by a 5-year-old. Because in order to give away enough commemorative pens for everyone, they write every letter with a different pen, and then they trace over some of the letters
what?
With new
no.
pens. Yes, literally, she spent like 100 hours. Signing the bill, and if you look at her signature on the bill, it looks like half of it's been traced over. And it's because she needed to have enough pens for everyone.
That's so stupid.
No. But that apparently is, like, I kept going to staffers and being like, is this a thing? And they were
yeah.
like, yeah, no, they do this all the time. And I was like, why?
What on earth?
What?
So
but so that's
weird.
How I got a pen. But it was great. I've now had what I would contend are the two most powerful women in America at least pretend to recognize me. As you know, from years ago, Hillary Clinton pretended to know who I was
right.
at one 9/11 health event in like 2006 or something.
Sure.
And this time at the signing, because that was then the third time that Nancy Pelosi had seen me in this
right.
cycle.
Yeah, fairly, you know, in a
right.
short amount of time.
Right. Like the, you know, I had been there on one of, you know, the day of the testimony. I met her very briefly, but yep. she didn't really register who I was, I don't think. And then I met her again at that press conference. Yep. And I also had to meet her right before, the, you know, at the, before the press conference, I got introduced yep. to her. And so this is the, and she had just seen me speak. So this is the third time she's seen me. And yeah. Carolyn Maloney went to introduce me, and she was like, no, of course I know her. Uh-oh. She spoke at our last press event.
Oh, my. Yeah.
So I've now had two of the most powerful women in politics.
That's amazing.
Recognize me.
I'm jealous.
So I feel like I achieved that, at least. Yeah, I don't know what did. Else I achieved, but that felt like it.
Well, you achieved helping getting this the VCF right. passed.
And I helped get this bill passed.
Right.
So
forever.
Forever.
Well, basically forever.
Right. Until so 20, until everyone's
right.
dead.
So you, right, exactly. So you will not have to continue to deal with this.
Right.
That's what you did.
Well, and I'm pretty happy about that because the, you know, for me, the part of the program that has always seemed like the best get is actually the health program. This is a great thing if you are like critically ill, and it's a great way to get people into the programs in general to find out about them because you're like offering money.
Yeah.
So if you're like, oh, hey, you can get a payout for even having asthma, then everyone's yeah. like, tell me more about everything.
Right.
Whereas if you have to, you know, if you are just offering healthcare, people are like, whatever, I have a doctor.
Right.
It's like how some people seem to think yeah. that people like their private insurance.
I was just
some
about
people
to
are
say, yes, they have healthcare
right,
that they love.
That so they love, have, they as we all do. But so it's a lot easier to get people interested in these programs if you tell them about the free money first.
Yeah, sure.
But I would contend that this is in many ways not the most important part of the program for people that are actually sick.
Sure.
And especially people who are sick and like lacking adequate health coverage.
Yeah.
And so I was just like, I'm glad this happened fast because I don't think that this is should have had to be a legislative priority for us in the way that it had to be in order to get this program sure. that seemed like an obvious. Of course, there should be a fucking fund. There's
right.
a fund for
right.
everything.
Right.
Like, obviously, there should be a fund.
Yeah.
But like the idea of having to go back to beg them for a fund when there are likely going to need to be some changes made to the health program at some point. You know, I mean, yeah. there's always, right. because needs are evolving and the people, yeah, yeah. you know, who are sick are identifying themselves.
Yeah.
So, like, to have to constantly go back to talk about what I think is not the least important part of these programs, but certainly from our perspective, the smaller get.
Yeah.
Was, I was kind of like, when do we get to talk about healthcare again?
Yeah, right.
Like,
right.
I care about healthcare. I consider myself a healthcare advocate. I
yeah.
care deeply about health policy, and that includes broader health policy.
Yeah.
And when you're talking about the VCF, you don't get a chance to talk about how the ACA laws, you know, being overturned will affect us. You don't get a chance to talk about the part
right.
of it that I'm actually the expert in.
Right.
You're just like, people need money when they get sick because they can't work.
Right.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, like, that feels yeah. obvious. And uh-huh. then you have to talk about how wronged you are by the situation, which at this point, it's like, how many years do you have to explain how wronged you are by a situation that has been, the wronging
right.
has been documented?
Well, right. So everybody's clear on that.
We all know how wronged we all were. But in any yeah. case, so I'm excited that it has passed. I don't know what to do with my life now. So if people have suggestions, then feel free. I have a lot more television experience than I used to. So if you want me to host a show where I just rant about politics,
sure.
I'm yeah. available, you know? Yeah. But in any case.
Well, the good news ends there.
That's where the last good news was. Because now.
Right, because now we have mass shootings to
right.
talk about.
Well, and here's the thing. You know that there were more mass shootings.
Yeah.
This
and,
is,
and it's also like the 250th and the yeah. 251st or something.
Well, at this point, I'm starting to notice that media sources are starting to report different numbers because the criteria they're using is different.
God.
And so, like, ugh. I saw one that was like, it's the 34th mass shooting of the year. And I was like, according, and that was like,
right.
that one required that like three or more people be, or like some ridiculous thing where I was
sure.
like, once you're having to qualify what category of mass shooting this fits into, we've
yeah.
all lost.
Yes, we have.
Well, and then we also had the Gilroy Garlic Festival,
well,
and that
right.
was only
last
week. Last so,
week. Yeah.
You know, and that was in California,
yeah,
where we live. So
right.
we felt very concerned about that
yes.
one.
Well, and that gun had been purchased, I believe, legally in Nevada. All of these guns are being purchased legally everywhere.
Well, here's the problem with having gun control be deferred to the states, essentially. Is
obviously.
That you can cross state lines with a gun without
yes.
anyone knowing.
That's it.
And
apparently
in California,
you can also order them online, too, because the guy from Dayton ordered his in Texas.
Oh, sure.
He got his gun in Texas.
Well, right. It's, I mean, the internet makes everything possible. You can't get fruit into California,
right.
but you can just easily.
They're all also assault weapons, obviously.
Right.
Because
weapons
what else
of
would
war,
they be? Right.
as they would be. Yeah, so this first one happened in El Paso at a Walmart. That
right.
one, straight white supremacist, wrote a manifesto online that is depressing to read. I don't recommend it.
No.
It sounds like a Donald Trump speech.
Well, it was. I mean,
right.
he had also retweeted Donald Trump a million different times. He was concerned about the invasion of the Mexicans and mixing of races and
right.
all of the things that you know,
racists are
that racists
worried
are
about.
Concerned with.
Yeah, right. It's a 21-year-old white guy, so he fits the profile perfectly yep. of exactly who commits a white supremacy mass shooting.
Yep.
And then in Dayton, we don't know the motive behind the killer, but what we do know is that he was a 24-year-old white guy.
Yes.
And so we've made some assumptions. We haven't made, you know.
Well, it's white domestic terrorism.
Exactly.
Whether it's a white supremacist
or just
domestic
an asshole.
Terrorism, we don't know. Right.
That's yeah. It's certainly a genre of domestic terrorism that is our biggest source of domestic terrorism.
Yes.
Which is just disgruntled young white men.
Yes.
Or sometimes middle-aged white men, I guess. But yes. Mostly young white men.
Well, and I'm glad also because I feel like I've been seeing some people today talk about... Because there were a lot of people yesterday were talking about, like, you know, we've got a white nationalist problem in this country.
Yes.
And we certainly do. But what we really have, like... But what we really have is a white domestic terrorism problem.
Yeah.
And, like, that can be committed by someone who considers themselves to be a white nationalist. But the... And
exactly.
we should deal with white nationalism.
Right.
But also, like, this is domestic terrorism.
Yeah.
So we need to go beyond just being like, oh, we've got some white people who are racist. Because we know that, and we
right.
probably always will. We have white people who
they
are
don't have to be shooting up Walmart.
Mass. That's it.
Also, though, right. Walmart sent their thoughts and prayers.
Sure.
Walmart is an open carry store in an open carry state.
Yes.
They sell guns at
yeah,
that store.
Yeah, where were all the good guys with the guns
yeah.
in a place that sells the guns?
Right, that, where you're allowed to carry them openly.
There?
There, not a single good guy found in that store, except for apparently people who were too afraid to get medical help because they're undocumented.
Yes.
So there were a lot of unarmed good guys
yeah,
in that store.
There's reports that we don't actually know how many people were injured.
Right.
Because
people were afraid
may have
not
gone to the hospital.
Seek medical help. Which, can you imagine
right.
the layers of fucked up all of that? Like,
well, and, I hate to sort of, like, I don't hate this. I was almost going to say I hate to use this as an example of why we need to change politics or policies. But it's like,
well,
no,
this is it.
You have to learn from these things.
Right.
But, like, this is, guys, when everybody was all up in arms in that first Democratic debate, when... all the candidates had their arms fly up that said that we should be giving health care to illegal immigrants.
Right. This is
it's
what
because
happens.
You don't want some of them to have to go leave something like this and
without
die
care.
Because they're just not going to a hospital because they're not going to get care once they're
well,
there.
Well, and here's if you are just...
Or they're
going to
be deported once they get there.
Still an asshole, even after that talking point, because you don't have the empathy to imagine what it is to be shot in a mass shooting by a white
right.
supremacist and
or
not be able to seek medical
anyway,
care.
Anyway, but certainly to be shot
imagine
in a mass.
That it's an undocumented person with... the measles.
Well, sure.
The reason you want them to be able to seek medical care
right.
is so that you don't get the measles.
Yes,
it's so
correct.
That they can get the vaccine before
yes.
you get the measles. Like,
yeah.
there's reasons that are public health reasons beyond
right.
just being nice people that you would want this, just in case you're
right.
still an asshole.
And
but
speaking of public health...
Being a nice person is part of it.
This is a public health problem.
Right. When we're not allowed to say that because of the Dickey Amendment, but here we are. We're not allowed to study it as a public health problem because
yeah.
the gun industry has made it so that we can't.
Yeah.
But here's the thing about all policies... You can change them.
You can change those.
So the Dickey yep. Amendment, we could just decide we don't want it anymore.
Yep.
And I, you know, that was a point that I don't think she made very well in the first debate, but that Liz
yeah,
Warren
Liz
talked
Warren
about
talked
in the
about
first
it.
Debate is
yeah.
the reason that she was going on about our need for research on this as a public health issue
right.
is because we don't currently have the ability to do that research.
Yeah.
And so the data that would really drive this conversation into a different place,
we just don't have. Yeah.
Because... It's one thing to hear about an isolated mass shooting in three different cities at once or whatever's always going on in this
yeah.
country. It's another thing when you start to see statistics about how many people are affected by gun violence and what the trick, you know, what the effects of that are beyond the actual shooting,
yeah.
what, you know, whether you see things like substance abuse
yeah.
In rise in those communities. Like, there are all these other effects that actually become very expensive for a society to deal with that are part of the trauma of living through a mass tragedy like that,
right.
that we can't study in a meaningful way because we're not allowed to study the effects of gun violence as a public health concern.
Yeah.
So in any case, this is, I mean, we're sort of, I think we're in a slightly better place for one reason, which is I have heard more people say domestic terrorism after these shootings than I've ever heard. We have been for years reminding everyone that
yeah.
these shootings are domestic terrorism. It doesn't matter if, you know, terrorism doesn't have to be Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. No.
And,
well, and it's probably good that I think this is one place where most, if not all, of the Democratic candidates for president sort of can come to some general agreement on, and they all definitely want to do something about guns. And I think, like, the majority of them I have seen today who released a statement or yesterday has been in some part either tying this to Trump or talking about domestic terrorism or talking about white nationalism. I feel like it's the fact that we've got 24 people running for president who this might be the only thing they can get on the same page about.
Right. It's an exciting.
That's helpful. Yeah. You know, I mean, or it could be helpful.
The problem is that like 98% of Americans are on the same page about this.
Yeah.
It's not controversial to say you want background checks.
Right.
It is controversial to melt all the guns, which is one of the things that we've been proponents of on this podcast. And I saw a melt the guns hashtag going around. So I know we're not the only ones.
Well, I mean, honestly, Eric Swalwell was the closest thing to melt the guns just because he was wanting to do
take them away.
Mandatory buybacks. Yeah. And of course, he's not running for president any longer. And he was never going to be president anyway. But I mean,
but it was worth having someone in the debate give us the idea.
Right.
Someone could pick up the ball and run with it.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, it's not like, of course they should all be on the same page because all of them, like every voter is on the same page in the whole country. Like being on this, it's not like being on the same page about Iran. You know, like there's there's times where people aren't on the same page and there's a clear right side and wrong side in certain people's opinions, i.e. mine. But there's not... This is like one where like the side of rightness is more just a side of like what scale are we willing to go to accomplish rightness?
Yes.
It's but if you're not in favor of doing something, then
you're in favor of wrongness.
Well, and you're also you're an extremist because that's a position only 2% of the country is taking or whatever.
Yeah, totally.
You know?
Yeah.
I feel heartened that domestic terrorism has entered the conversation as a term. I feel heartened that more people are saying white nationalism is a form of domestic terrorism.
Totally.
Because that is, I think, where we often, when you just call it white nationalism, you almost act like it's a political ideology.
Yes, that's
and
that.
It's not.
Yeah, right.
White nationalism is a terrorist ideology.
Yeah.
It is an ideology designed to make misery for other people.
Yes.
It's not like a fun voting ideology for, you know, once you're identifying yourself as a white nationalist, like you are identifying yourself with an organized white domestic terrorist movement.
Yeah. Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And so that's different than just saying I'm conservative or even saying I'm a racist, which no one is saying, but people should be. But, you know, it's different than saying that you are associating yourself with an avowed national movement that is a domestic terrorist organization or a collection of organizations.
Yeah.
In any case, okay, let's talk about the debates. That's what we came to talk about.
Obviously.
Gun violence always interrupts the most exciting podcasts. There's always a shooting when something super silly has happened on the electoral politics side.
I know.
And we don't want to have to talk about guns.
No, we wanted to talk about 6 hours of debates.
Thank you.
God.
Night one.
And the best 3 hours of all 12 of them that we've had so far.
Oh, yeah.
Was night one of this week's.
You guys, we had been complaining, I now know wrongly, about how they put Bernie and Liz in like the kiddie debate with a bunch of nobodies. And that we were going to have no voice for the left, which was true, in the second night. And that the second night, because of that, was going to become the debate. And the first night was going to be nothing. Night one was where it's at. And let me tell you, Team Bernie Warren.
Oh.
Team Bernie Liz / Sanders Warren. I never get the right combo.
It was a massacre.
Oh, my God. I wish that they could collectively be the president.
I know. Yes.
They together are the perfect president.
Yes.
Because together, they had like a bunch of generic white people screaming at them from both sides. All the people that no one can remember.
Yep.
John Delaney got the third most speaking time in that debate. He is the least real person in this race.
Because CNN somehow decided that he was going to be their foil for the progressives, which... worked out great
because he was the one who was willing to be the attack dog by saying stupid shit.
Yes, exactly.
And then that gave Liz Warren a chance to say smart shit.
Yes.
And that's how this all started.
Yes,
so
exactly.
Them double teaming people and not attacking each other, which,
so great.
Why would they attack each other? There's no reason in this stage of the race to attack
each
other.
We'll have to at some
point. Yeah, but I think even
their
version of attacking each other is going to be more on style than substance. There's no way for them to meaningfully attack each other on substance, aside from nitpicking very minor things. And once we're at that stage, I don't think we'll ever get to a stage where they aren't in a position to double team a third party.
Oh, well, for sure.
One of them will drop out before that happens. Like, it's not going to be the two of them as the two finals.
Oh, no, right. Yeah, yeah.
So they're never going to be in a position where there's no foil for them to double team onto. Yeah. So at some point, one of them will probably have to step out.
Yeah.
But that choice is not going to be made because they were attacking each other, I think.
Well, and what
I could be wrong.
What we found, and I think that this is what, like, the big overarching thing from the whole night was, and Warren sort of said it in that great quote where she sort of slammed Delaney, but, which we'll get to.
Yeah.
But, like, I think the thing was, and this is what even some of the moderates on CNN said, Terry McAuliffe, who I can't stand the sight of.
Sure.
And, you know, David Axelrod, who's fine sometimes and other times is doesn't get it. But, like, all of them after that debate were just sort of like, if this is what the moderates versus progressives battle is going to look like, then the moderates are going to have to do a much better job going forward. And basically, like, all they did was just say, like, no.
Yes.
They were just the party of we can't have nice things. Well, and, like, that's the thing that, like, they were all saying. Like, and, like, it's, I mean, look, I'm not going to agree with you if you're a moderate.
Right.
But, like, you have to, and we learned this in 2016, painfully.
The hard way.
You have to, if you are a moderate, you have to show me why it is that that is what you stand for, as opposed to just telling me that I'm
I can't have the best version dealing
in fairy tale politics, well, or economy.
There's a premise that is the sort of central premise of this debate, but is not actually the central problem, which is, and it's something that we saw in 2016, but it wasn't as stark, because I think that's where Liz Warren really adds value, because she can explain the distinction between what she and Bernie think and what the rest of these guys think in a way that Bernie can't. Bernie is...
Yeah, he's not as good as that.
Well, and it's not his style. Right. You know, he's communicating a vision, and he just doesn't get derailed by other people's visions. Liz Warren is good at explaining why her vision is better than the other vision.
Right.
And so I think these moderates would like us to believe that we're all in favor of these things, but some of them are just not feasible.
Right.
But what the reality is that these moderates are in favor of ceding a certain amount of political control to corporations.
Right.
And they are in favor of policies that leave room for people to die, that leave room for people to not be protected, that leave room for vulnerable Americans to fall through the cracks, because they think it's just not feasible to bother doing the vision thing. And what the progressives are saying is not, I can promise you that Medicare for All, as I see it, will happen tomorrow.
Right.
What they are saying is, we should ask
it's
for
the
that.
The big dream. Right.
And I think the media wants to portray it as, and this is where the debate questions were really, you know, sort of targeting this sense that, like, well, if this isn't feasible, why are you saying it? And it's like, the job of the president is to convince you that their vision is the one that we want to follow. It's not to convince you that they know what's feasible before having tried anything.
Right.
You don't actually know what's feasible if you haven't tried things yet.
Yeah.
None of these people have been the president before.
No, I know. And that's the other thing is too, and this is where we get so angry with the party in so many instances, is that, you know, the Republicans aren't afraid to say the thing.
Right.
And certainly Donald Trump isn't, you know, I mean, he's
whether
not
a, or not it's a thing that contradicts his last thing. He doesn't care.
Say, you know, he's not afraid to tell you that Mexico is going to build the wall.
No.
You
right.
know, or whatever else it is that
his
he's going
to. His wildest fantasy is Mexico building the wall. And he promised us it would happen because he doesn't fucking care.
Right.
He'll say
and
the
like,
thing.
And this is so many people on the left are just sort of like, if you all claim to have this principle that you would like everyone to be covered. Like, if you would like everyone to have healthcare, you would like everyone in America to be insured. Because that was the thing. All 20 people up on that
would
stage
would openly say they love universal healthcare is their goal.
Were saying, right. And but then they would say, but you can't actually do it.
Right.
And here's a worse plan than actually doing it that will still leave however many millions of people off and also make you pay for your health insurance and still have to pay premiums and deductibles and all of those things.
Right.
So it's like, why can't we just say that we want the thing and then maybe we get it, maybe we have to work for it, maybe it takes a decade, maybe
central distinction. I think that there is a central distinction between voters who naturally appeal to this pragmatist talk and who naturally like want to have a dream. That's I think what the distinction between the sort of Clinton Sanders camps was.
Sure.
I think that the problem is that what we're not considering is that the reason these politicians are proponents of these halfway measures is oftentimes because they are in favor of halfway measures. Their best case scenario, Joe Biden doesn't actually want us to have Medicare for all, you guys. He wants there to be room for private insurance. He wants them to make money. He doesn't care. He thinks it is an okay compromise that some people under that system will never get insured. And because of that, there will be people who do not have access to healthcare in America. Yep. That is an okay compromise for him. He wants a system where people can make money. That's his goal. His goal is not universal healthcare. His priority is not universal healthcare. Right. He can say, well, it would be nice if we had universal healthcare, because of course it would be fucking nice if we had universal healthcare.
Of course.
But if his priority is not universal healthcare, don't let him tell you that it's not pragmatic to have it. He doesn't care if we have it. He doesn't want it. That's what I think is so frustrating. Like, it's one thing, you know, I understand why this appeal works with voters, but I don't understand why it's continuing to work with people who are not saying in these debates, oh, of course our goal is Medicare for all. You know, there's the contingent that's saying our goal is Medicare for all, but we have to go these halfway measures.
Right.
There is a meaningful debate happening right now from people who actually don't want us to have universal health, that Medicare for all is not their goal. I would even contend that Kamala Harris's plan doesn't actually have Medicare for all as a goal.
Sure.
Her plan has profits for corporations as a goal.
Yeah.
That is never going to truly be Medicare for all. Any plan that has involvement from private interests is inevitably going to make care unfeasible for certain people.
Yeah.
That is just how it works, you guys. I'm sorry that if your theory about how it works isn't panning out, if you think that the market best handles things, it's proven that it doesn't.
It doesn't.
So it's too late now. Yeah. Now what do we do? You know, like, but so I think this debate really made that distinction clear, where John Delaney was not just saying, oh, guys, this is going to be too hard.
Yeah.
He was, I think, making a very clear argument that it's not what he wants.
Sure.
He doesn't want us to have universal care. He doesn't care if we get there. Everyone thinks that's a fine byproduct of their plan.
Right.
No one is against universal care.
Right. Exactly.
But that is not his priority. And the moderates showed in this debate, because John Delaney was the face of them, and he had such an angry red
face,
too.
And Steve Bullock.
Yeah. And
who was making his first appearance.
And who says,
well, and presumably
he says
last.
Nuclear like Bush.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I was just like, he made a fumble during that conversation. I can't remember what it was, but I was too distracted by his nuclear policy. I was just like,
yeah.
In a Democratic debate, I know that that's classist and bullshit, but like, we just.
No.
You have to do better. You can't reference George Bush that way.
No.
Even if you're a wild Western state governor.
Yeah.
But in any case, John Delaney being the face, and John Delaney is just there to tell us we can't have things. His whole proposal,
his
whole platform is that we just shouldn't dream too big.
Yep.
It's to be pragmatic.
Yep.
But it gave Warren so many great openings.
Really did.
I mean, so in response to his Medicare for All will ruin America because it's too big to dream, she said, we should stop using Republican talking points in order to talk with each other about how to best provide healthcare. And that is the crux for me of the healthcare conversation that is missing, right? Like, I have been waiting for someone to say that, because when we talk about whether we should have an incremental approach or not, whatever, the plan that we have under the ACA is a Heritage Foundation plan. We've said this many times on the podcast.
Yeah.
It was a Republican proposal from the 80s that we adopted when they moved to the sharp right.
Right.
It is not the Democratic plan for healthcare of yore. We made it up during the new Democratic era because we moved to the right.
Yes.
So it is not the frame, the right frame for the debate.
No.
The debate is, should we actually try to have universal care, or are we okay with people not having care?
Yeah.
And half of the Democrats are saying they're okay with people not having care.
Right.
That's a Republican priority structure.
Yeah.
Right. You know, if your structure is corporate profits over people having care, then you are advocating a Republican talking point.
Yes.
And she finally said it.
Yeah. And Bernie also said it, too, but he was saying it to the CNN moderators.
Right.
Because
the question was framed wrong, too.
Right, it was.
Because the question was like, Bernie, Liz, isn't it too big to dream? Basically.
Right.
You know, the question was
like
aren't you crazy?
What happens when everyone's taxes go up?
Right.
And they kept asking if people's taxes would go up.
Right.
And I still feel like neither of them quite.
No, she did.
She
said the thing where she was like, your taxes will go up, but your costs will go down.
Yes.
That's the answer. But it's hard to say in the 5 seconds that they give you to answer the question. And so nobody was ever able to get the right word in, because the answer is.
That's closer than Bernie's ever got.
Here's the thing.
He never explained that.
Your taxes might go up.
Right.
You will save money.
Yes.
That's the problem with this. The whole reason someone like John Delaney can even make an argument in this debate is because you can say, yeah, people's taxes will probably go up.
Yeah.
But their expenses will come down.
Right, exactly.
In any case. And then Beto also tried to use the people can keep their insurance. And Buttigieg was into that. I know that I've ranted about this already on the podcast, but I'm going to do it again. Nobody likes their employer-sponsored insurance, you guys.
Obviously.
People like their doctors.
Yes.
They want to be able to keep their doctors. They're worried that you're going to take away their doctors. Medicare for All, because it puts all the doctors into one pool, doesn't take away your doctors. But you know what does? A fucking plan like Kamala Harris's, where private insurers are in the Medicare system.
Yes.
That might take away your doctors. No, it, like, that could be worse than your employer-sponsored plan. But you know what won't be? Medicare for All.
Yeah.
So just, that talking point made a resurgence in the second night because there were no real progressives in that. Like, it was a mess. But...
Right, except Bill de Blasio, who's like, you know, down on the end, just sort of like...
Like ranting from the corner about, I mean, so. I was glad he was there. Because
I was too.
I have never, and this is something that I think I've, no, I was, no, you know, I was in New York. I was noticing that the way that this got discussed in New York, because everyone in New York is like, why is he running for president? He's not a popular mayor right now. Like, he has a lot of issues with like the police department, and they've been really like dragging him
and
in the press. And
too,
that came up, and he's not even handling it well from the other side because both the police department hates him and everyone hates him for not being strong enough on the police department. So it's like a mess. But every time that you ask them about the debates, they're like, well, yeah, I am glad he's there.
Right, I know. Yeah. Well, we needed him on the second night.
People who hate him are like, yeah, no, I was glad he was there. But in any case, so a couple more notable quotes.
Yeah, the biggest one, really, I think, from that night.
The biggest one from that night was another Liz Warren one.
Yes.
That was also in response to Delaney doomsdaying.
Oh, my God.
Where she said, I don't understand why anybody goes to all the trouble of running for president of the United States just to talk about what we really can't do and shouldn't fight for. I don't get it.
Yeah.
And that is it.
It was erupted. The room erupted.
That she had been, her and Sanders had been standing in the middle of a room full of angry white men.
Yeah.
Screaming from either side. And Marion Williamson, who was just in her own.
We'll get there in a
second. She was in her own conversation. But like Amy Klobuchar was there theoretically, but no one heard from her.
Oh, right. Yeah,
but they were basically in a ring of angry Midwestern men with red faces telling them what we can't have.
Yeah.
And
no, for sure.
I to the extent that I think they, first of all, they were being condescended to hardcore.
Yeah.
And that is Sanders' most notable quote of the night was actually another Tim Ryan blunder. Tim Ryan always gets himself into this trouble.
Yeah.
Where he said... Bernie said something about under Medicare for All, dental and vision would be covered.
Yeah.
And Tim Ryan said, you don't know that. And Bernie said back, I do know. I wrote the damn bill.
Yeah.
Which
was so good.
Epic.
Yeah.
But.
I think he has, I wrote the damn bill.
All right. I got offered, I donated to him that night and then already, like the next minute, got an email saying I could get a sticker that said if I donated again. And I was like, get over yourselves, people. I donated in response to how many great lines they each had. So I donated more to Liz Warren because I felt like she had the most lines.
Yeah.
But then I felt bad because I kind of want to keep Sanders in the race, obviously.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I'll donate to him too.
Yeah. Outside of those two, and come at me if you want.
I'm about to at you.
Marianne Williamson was the third best person on the stage that night.
That's a crazy thing to say.
But
she
fight
had
me.
She had the third best quote of the night.
But she also was like... No one spoke more eloquently on the Flint water crisis than she did.
Yes, no, that's true.
She would have convinced, I think, anyone who was paying half attention to her, even though she sounded like a loon, that we should be paying out reparations.
Right. Yeah, she came at them on reparations in a way that I was like, oh,
right,
we're doing it.
And she had my favorite quote of the night, actually, even more so than both of Bernie and Liz's, because I felt like it might have even
it was the thing
got
that
to
you,
the crux of the issue more even than Liz's did, although it was sort of like a...
It was in the same genre.
It was in the same genre of quote. But, like, I think this sort of, like, really gets down to sort of, like...
This really points
to... Who we are as, like, a party.
Yes. And it, like, points to exactly what the cynical arguments were arguing.
Right. And she said, I almost wonder why you're Democrats. You seem to think there's something wrong about using the instruments of government to help people.
Yeah.
And that is always like, I mean, that really is sort of like
that's
what makes us who we are.
Yeah.
It's not, I mean, like when you're really getting down to sort of like technicalities, I guess. Liz's was sort of like, she was like, don't tell, right. But hers was sort of like a, you know, a
was
bigger
the, was
idea
the broader version of
pitch,
it, yeah.
Which sort right. of like landed harder. But this is just sort of like, yeah, yes, you're absolutely right. Like, what are we doing here? If we're going to say, no, the government actually can't give healthcare to people.
Right, like, this is not your like, party if you right. don't think then that the government can do things.
Then see you later. You know?
Also, like, don't run for president just to not think government works.
Well, right, I know, I mean, exactly.
At least hope that
so
government
that
could work.
So that was just like, when she said that, yeah. I was like, yes. I was like shaking my fists at the
she
TV.
Bookended it with
oh, there was a lot of other crazy,
craziness.
Don't get me wrong. But I mean, like, if you're holding a gun to my head and telling me to rank the 10 that were standing up there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, no, she had a much third. Better night than the last time.
Oh, for sure.
She still, at the very beginning, got asked one question during the healthcare debate where she basically said, well, I think everyone has good ideas.
Oh, I know.
And I was like, okay, you got to have a health plan.
And then also, I think, sort of said that she was also scared about Medicare for All, which sort of like then sort of like just completely takes away from this statement here.
It validated everybody who was hedging, like the Buttigieg Beto people, without offering any sort of validation of anything else.
Yeah, because I don't know if she has a healthcare plan.
She
probably
doesn't. No, she didn't even know. She
likes to talk about how we only have sick care plans.
Yeah.
She's not wrong about, but like that's not going to... You know.
Exactly. She looked like a deer in headlights when she got asked that question, and then literally responded with, "Everyone has had good thoughts here."
Yeah.
Like, and I was like, "No."
Yeah.
Some people haven't had good thoughts. That's the problem that we're having.
Yeah.
Depending on who you are, one of these groups of people isn't having good thoughts.
Yeah.
If you have a thought on healthcare, then you don't agree with one of these sides.
Yeah.
Like, you might think everyone has good intentions.
Right.
But
right.
not everyone has had good thoughts.
There's been a lot of stupid thoughts
there's
up here tonight.
Some stupid thoughts. And depending on what your position is on healthcare, it's different people. If you're a John Delaney fan, then certainly Liz Warren had some stupid thoughts.
Sure. Yeah.
But you don't think everyone up there was saying the same thing if you're listening.
No.
So, and then at the very end, it was so funny. Her closing statement, she was like really going with
it was great.
And then the last sentence.
It wasn't.
I can't remember what she said, but it was Looney Tunes crazy land. Yeah,
I know.
And she just, her final note was like, oh, right, this is Marianne Williamson.
Yeah.
Like, but you know what was fascinating?
But I also, I do want her to stay.
Yeah, she's kind of fun.
Right?
Yeah.
And why not?
I do like, I think it's great to have someone up there actually saying, because when they get asked about reparations, they always go on about commissions, like they're going to form all these commissions.
Yes.
It is kind of fascinating to have someone up there being like, what if we just paid reparations?
Right.
And, like, listen, her numbers are made up by her. So it's not, like, a fair number.
But she did have them.
But she had
them. She's the first person that I've ever heard use math when talking about reparations.
Yes, exactly. And that's, I think that was, even if you think that's a crazy number, because I don't know what the right number, obviously no one knows what the right number is for reparations. But the idea that anyone would be challenged to come up with one is really the first step towards paying reparations is thinking about them in concrete terms at all instead of as a theoretical idea.
Right.
So if you are someone who's in favor of reparations, then you should also be someone who is comfortable going to the step of wondering what money that would be.
Right.
And if you're not, then have a reason that you're not. But having just like 1,000 commissions with Sheila Jackson Lee is not the answer to the question unless you don't actually feel like answering the question, which is actually what everyone else's position on the stage was.
And it's important to note, in case you're not following us on Twitter, before that debate, and it was before that debate.
Yes.
We posted on, we tweeted.
We said it.
That Marianne Williamson was.
We have a moment.
At some point, gonna be a thing.
Yeah. And as usual.
It was then.
We got it spot on.
Yeah.
But we also did say in that tweet, don't worry, even Ben Carson was the front runner for a while.
Right, sure.
Because everyone's gonna have a moment, you guys. Like,
That's
Pete Buttigieg had a moment after the last debate. Yeah. He's not going to have as big a moment after this one because no one could remember he was there because he wasn't exciting in this debate.
But the day
he did have a bug on his head, to be fair.
He did. A smushed bug.
We spent a lot of time and wondering about the smushed bug on his head.
Yeah, that's
wondering
what it was.
He said it was. Well, I saw a lot of speculation on Twitter about what it was before that ranged from gum to, you know.
Yeah, dirt, schmutz.
Dirt, schmutz, bugs.
Yeah.
Someone put frosting.
Right.
Uh-huh. I mean, there were a lot of options.
Right. It wasn't...
It was the biggest mystery of the night.
It wasn't, you know, any leftover...
Hair goop?
You know, good ideas, certainly.
Certainly not. He wasn't having a lot of those that night.
No.
And he almost... Like, Beto,
he was okay.
He was fine.
Though. I mean, but.
But he was not notable. Like, Beto is an irrelevant human being at this point.
Yeah, we got that right, too,
I mean,
by the way.
Beto is not a person, you guys. Right. So don't worry about him.
I feel like. Hang on just a second here. Because I feel like now that we've mentioned being right about Marianne Williamson, we said that Beto O'Rourke was going to crash and burn.
We knew it.
Because he was garbage. We said that Liz Warren was going to be a
slow,
slow
but
burn,
steady surge. Yeah.
As opposed to a crash and burn. She was going to be a slow burn.
Yeah.
I feel like what big ideas about this race have we been wrong about?
Nothing.
None, obviously.
No.
Yeah.
We.
This is where you come, guys. Tell your friends.
Yeah. This is where you come. This is our third presidential cycle. We actually live for this information.
Yeah, we see
this
things.
This is our bread and butter. Like, maybe don't come here if you just want a really nuanced gun control conversation, because we obviously didn't bring you that.
No.
But if you want to know what to expect when it comes to presidential electoral politics, we are literally the best sources on that.
That's right.
We have analyzed every race down to the penguin bite.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
We have a long memory that ranges deep into the primary cycle.
It does.
You know, we start at the beginning of the primary cycle during these races, and we follow them through.
Yeah.
So we know things.
Yeah.
It's how we knew that Hillary Clinton was a bad idea in the first place.
Right, exactly.
I believe in 2013,
we told you 2 years before it was a bad idea.
Exactly.
Yeah.
3 years.
Before it was an officially bad idea.
Right.
It was always a bad idea.
Right. It was a bad idea from the get-go. We made that warning early. But so in any case, we're your source.
Yeah.
Night two.
What a snore.
I mean,
I thought,
after
anyway.
The first,
I mean,
the fireworks for the first night. Because the first night, I also found myself clapping alone in my house periodically. Like, I got very excited about some of the snapbacks from Bernie and Liz. And so I was, like, cheering in my house. And my neighbors probably thought I was crazy, but that's fine. This didn't have that sparkle.
No. And it had, it wasn't because it was a lack of their, they all went at each other.
Yeah.
And some unexpected people went at some unexpected people.
So true.
But, I mean, it just didn't have, like, that first one just felt like it was a debate about the big idea of who we are as a party.
Yeah.
And that was because the two progressives and a bunch of boring moderates were on there. And the next night was, like, boring moderates, and then some people who are sort of, like, fashioning themselves as, like, half progressives.
Well, I also think that there's a big distinction. The big distinction between the two nights is that on the first night, nobody talked about anyone's record. It was just about their ideas moving forward.
Yeah,
because what are you going to say to Bernie Sanders about his record?
Well, sure.
Like, Bernie Sanders has no party, basically.
Right.
And has been going it solo in first the House and then the Senate for years. And he actually gets a lot of amendments passed because he works with anyone who shares his agenda. And in the same way, like, Liz Warren has been very consistent for the most part since she's been in office. And she's also a noted expert in her field. And so there's no...
And beyond that, nobody cares what John Delaney voted on anything.
No, John Delaney is an irrelevant human being who's not currently in office, and no one cared about what he did in the first place.
Right.
And Tim Ryan looks like an angry linebacker from your high school who is in a little over his head. I'm not going to lie.
Yes.
But so, you know, nobody really got into the kind of, like, attacks that you found in the second night, because in the first night, it was really just about ideas.
It was just about big ideas.
And the second night was more people, you know, they talked a little bit about the big ideas too, but for the most part, there wasn't the same dissension on the big ideas, so there wasn't as exciting a debate there, so instead they had to come at each other.
Yeah, exactly.
The best line of the night, or the most memorable line of the night, was actually the cattiest line of the night, which was Gillibrand saying, if she became the president, first I'd Clorox the Oval Office, and then, you know, she listed what she was going to do.
That was good.
People loved it.
Yeah.
It was an exciting night in that there were protesters.
Yeah. Well, and also, it started off, like, with some drama.
Yes.
Because, you know, Biden gets introduced, and then Harris goes out, and he shakes her hand and says, "Go easy on me, kid."
Yeah.
So, immediately, people were just sort of like, can't be doing that.
No. It's like he made a gaffe before he even had the chance to speak.
Yeah. But, you know, they continued to talk about how terrible it would be if you lost your employer-based healthcare.
Yeah, your wonderful, all-encompassing employer-based healthcare that...
I feel like the person who sort of, like, defended losing your employer-based healthcare the most was Andrew Yang, probably, just because he was talking about how we should want to separate it from our employers because it would be easier to...
Change jobs,
and it would also be easier to, for employers to not have to worry about that.
Yeah, Andrew Yang, notably Ty Free once again.
Notably what?
Tie-free once again.
Oh, tie-free. Oh, yeah.
But the second night also, we should remember that one of the two greatest proponents of being the only people on Earth who know anyone with health problems are Bennett and Biden, who both, you know, love to dig into their back. Healthcare is personal to them, unlike you, because they have a family member who was sick once.
Right.
You know how rare that is.
Yeah.
But so the attack was really focused on Harris's plan.
Right.
Which is
crazy. From Biden talking about how expensive it was going to be.
Biden's plan, by the way, is to have $1,000 deductible on your...
And only have a public option into Obamacare and just fix the things that Trump took out of Obamacare.
Yeah.
That's literally his
plan. His plan is just Obamacare.
His plan is Obamacare. His plan is the Obamacare that they tried to pass before the moderate Dems...
Before Ben Nelson got his hands
on it.
Yeah.
Before they passed it. Right.
And that plan involves you being able to buy into a Medicare plan that has a huge deductible that is twice the amount of money that Americans don't already have saved for an emergency or whatever. You know,
correct.
A lot of conversation about that was going on where... And $1,000 deductible is cute when you live in a country where most people can't actually get the cash together for a $500 emergency.
I will say that, and this is always going to be her problem because she's been all over the map on this, but when they asked Biden about Kamala Harris's plan, he was like, well, she's had about three or four of them so far.
And he's not wrong.
He is not wrong.
And...
I'd take hers over his if I had to pick one of the two.
Battle of also, terrible plans,
right,
sure.
Right, exactly. But also, not
my favorite thing about last week was Pramila Jayapal on Twitter slamming Harris's health plan for her calling it Medicare for All. Because, so Harris's plan, I just want to talk for a moment about Harris's plan because she keeps calling it Medicare for All. So I want to be clear about why it's not. Her plan basically does what Medicare Advantage does. It has Medicare... sort of administrated through private health insurers.
Yes.
I am a person who actually is on a public program. I get secondary insurance from a public program that is administrated through a private insurer. So I have experience with this. Yeah. And I am also a person who just told Brent right before this podcast began that I had finally cleared up a 2-year billing problem that had to do with my private insurer, my primary private insurer, and the hospital billing system.
But wouldn't you like to keep them if you could, though?
Of course. I mean, they provide such great care. I only ever have to deal with them when I have a huge billing problem, which only happens 5 or 6 times a year. But so I know exactly what we are putting ourselves, like what the drawbacks of having a private plan be on a public system are. They include the fact that your network remains limited. They include the fact that the way the billing system works still ends up fucking you over because there's still spontaneous bills coming and no one's really sure who's paying for them and it's like chaos.
Yeah.
But they also don't do enough to contain costs because they mean that those private insurers are still negotiating independently with hospitals and other healthcare providers, which means that the government as a whole is not setting prices. The prices are being set by a bunch of private insurers who want to make a profit. And then on the flip side, it also means that the government is paying your tax dollars into a system that provides for corporate profit instead of a system that is streamlined so that corporate profit is cut out of the money mix.
Yes.
So it's more expensive for taxpayers.
Yeah. Well, and we've sort of found that out by the surprising source, Tulsi Gabbard.
I mean, she was there to bust some myths that night.
She really was coming specifically for... Harris, which was interesting because I don't know that anybody really saw that coming, but because Harris thought she had a real good sort of like ha-ha to Joe Biden because she, Kathleen Sebelius this last week endorsed Harris's plan.
Right.
Kathleen Sebelius ran HHS under Obama and this was who implemented Obamacare. Right. So Harris thinks that she's got like a real gotcha to Joe Biden.
Right.
And then from down the way comes Tulsi Gabbard, and she's like, by the way, Kathleen Sebelius works for Medicare Advantage, which is a private insurance company, so maybe it's not so great that that's who's, like, the big endorser of your plan. And I was like, oh, Tulsi Gabbard is
into the ring.
Back in the game.
Yeah.
Here.
No, it was a great check on exact... Because, first of all, the two of them are struggling with people to endorse any of their ideas.
Right.
Biden is trying to make it sound like, by having been in the Obama presidency, he doesn't need Obama's endorsement in order to take
and
credit for
him
Obama's
not to
endorsement.
Do it.
Right. Which is the opposite of what happened, according to common sense. And Harris is struggling to find anyone who believes she knows anything about healthcare.
Right.
Because it's clear she
because
doesn't.
Because she's proven that she doesn't.
Right. Exactly. And so to have... To try to mention that as if it's getting one over Biden because it's an Obama appointee who currently works in the private health insurance industry was such a fool move but exactly in line with what she is bringing right now in healthcare.
Right, she doesn't know. She didn't get it.
It's her plan is meant to address the fact that she has had three different positions on healthcare, and this plan makes it sound like that was all one position.
Right.
But that's why I'm saying the fact that Pramila Jayapal is not having that. And
right, that's how you know.
Is I was like, this for. Is an epic.
Yeah.
Like, she did it, you know, she didn't mention Harris's plan. What she instead did was said something about how she hates when people use Medicare for All to mean something that's not Medicare for All, and then linked an article about how Sanders' campaign is mad at Harris for calling it Medicare for All when it's not. And I was just like, this is so shade. This is for shade so forward.
Good. Yeah. But that bad blood between those two
didn't stop
there. Bled over into later in the evening because, again, like, seemingly out of nowhere, it was Tulsi Gabbard who came after Harris for her record as the Attorney General of California, which has not gone through any sort of scrutiny yet.
No, and it's crazy because it's the most controversial thing about her record.
Right,
in California,
exactly.
We know that, but not enough.
Well, and
even.
What I was going to say, not enough. And what was interesting to me was how well that played in the room. And I think that, to be quite honest, I think there were a lot of Black people in the room who were like, yes.
I mean, it's
I was saying to you earlier today, I was like, I have a small pool, but everybody who I know that follows politics closely and California politics closely that is Black is not trying to have Kamala Harris anywhere near the presidency.
No.
And it's because of the issues that Gabbard raised in that debate, because she's got a real sketchy record as the Attorney General here.
Yeah, no, that's, I think that's something that...
Well, it's not really sketchy, it's just it's not the progressive record that she likes to fashion it as.
Yeah, right. It's not progressive at all, really. And that's maybe something that, maybe in a future episode, we should sort of like do a deep dive into her record, because it's something we've mentioned a few times on the podcast, and I think that, you know, it's like, because A, no one knows what an Attorney General does, and B, no one knows what good or bad attorney generaling is.
Yeah.
It's a more it's complicated to explain why her record is bad in a meaningful way.
Right.
I mean, you can use talking points about, you know, three strike laws or whatever. Yeah. But, like, I think that's something we should dive into, because I have said since the beginning, another idea that I had that I think is an idea that we can say that will have been is that this record is going to come in late to the game and be a liability for her.
Yeah.
That it's going to take a while because no one fucking knows what attorney generals do for that to catch up with her. And because she's in the Senate now, and, you know, when she was attorney general, it was in California where most of the world doesn't live. But I don't think most Californians realized what was going on at the time. But I think that at some point, because there are other people in the race who have an incentive to get her on this.
Well, that's the thing.
You know,
I think
that Cory Booker knows about this this potential line of attack?
That's what I think was sort of the most interesting about this debate, was because there were a lot of, you know, I think people knew, and people tried it in the first debate, but they just quickly had their asses handed to them.
Right.
But, you know, they knew that this is going to be the last time that we're going to hear from some of these goons. And the ones who knew that that might be the case really came with anything that they could to sort of, like, make a splash.
I mean, that's what John Delaney was doing.
That's what John Delaney was trying to do.
Right.
Right. I think Tulsi Gabbard maybe a little bit...
She did had a little more bit to gain more because she could theoretically probably find the support to qualify if she made a big enough splash.
Sure. Yeah, there's no hope for John Delaney.
He's a fake person. Yeah. That's not, you know.
But the other, that sort of fight between the two of them even bled into after the debate.
Mm-hmm.
Because they interviewed Harris on CNN afterward, and she was just like, I'm not going to take any criticism from an Assad apologist. She went back to that again. Yeah. Which is like,
the media then picked up that ball and ran with it.
I was going to say, they really did. By the next morning, my entire Facebook had just decided that Kamala Harris's record as AG was off the table because Tulsi Gabbard is a Russian troll, basically.
Yeah.
Like, it was kind of like, okay, everyone.
Yeah,
like,
but I think that's going to keep plaguing her, and the more winnowed down the field gets, the more incentive people have to attack her for it.
Yeah.
I think early on, it's like a waste of an attack because it's something you can really, like, twist the knife with later on.
Yeah.
And later on, when there's smaller debates, they'll have time to actually discuss their records in depth, whereas at a big debate like that, you might run the risk of not getting your point across.
Yeah.
So I think that there are people waiting in the wings specifically to get her on this record issue, and they're waiting until a moment where they'll have the time to. And yeah. I'm sort of interested to see what happens.
Yeah, I think we may not see her again. But, I mean...
No, I don't think that we'll see
Gabbard
again. Right. Yeah, yeah. But you don't think that there's four other people who are going to be ready with that?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I think... I think someone like Cory Booker expects to make it into the next round.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He
probably will.
Yeah. Yeah. I, like someone like him expects to have this opportunity again. And someone like him is ready with this information.
Yeah.
Just the same way that busing thing was a perfect small soundbite in the first debate to get Biden with. Like they are saving some fire for later debates when they'll have a little more time.
Yeah.
So she also was just not as spectacular in this debate
as she
was in the first one.
No,
she came without a clear sort of enemy that kind of created that sharp contrast between her and Biden that was the two of them. With Tulsi Gabbard in the mix, it got confusing.
Well, that was the thing. There were more sort of like random attacks going here.
Well, because she's the one with all the momentum right now.
Right.
So people came ready to get her.
For her. Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That's,
yeah.
You know, when you're the person with the momentum, you got to be ready.
Yeah.
So in any case, there were some fun protests that went on inside the hall.
There were.
Nope. First night, everyone behaved themselves except for one man who there was at the very beginning. They have some like marching band or something come and like play the national anthem or whatever. Yeah. And they just had the longest shot of this guy just like scratching his ass on television. And I was just like, what would possess you to be next to the camera this way and think this is a good time for this?
Right.
In any case,
the
second night had a guy who was on his cell phone the whole time for that same stretch.
And the protesters had to be removed, though, because they were pretty loud.
Yeah.
One of them started with de Blasio, and then it sort of like slowed down a little bit and then picked back up again with Booker, which was confusing.
No.
But it was basically protesting that the police officer who killed Eric Garner had not been fired yet.
Yeah, because that's a big controversy right now in particular, because that...
Right. Which de Blasio got asked about and gave some sort of like half answer about like, oh, well, we're expecting that he's going to, you know, the family is going to receive justice finally, you know,
it's and like, it's just fire this fucker.
Right. And then they came down to Kirsten Gillibrand, another New Yorker, and they were like, what do you think? And he was like, and she immediately was like, yeah, he should be fired. And if I were the mayor, I would freaking fire his ass.
This is an interesting dynamic, though, because I was just listening to one sort of New York State politician or New York federal politician talking about why it's important to have good relationships with the mayor's office in New York City. Mm. Because, you know, when there's a water main break in her district, she has to be able to call the mayor and have them respond to it. She has to be able to call her a bunch of city council people and get action on things that are not in the federal purview, but the constituents call her with and blame her for.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of like, this is a bold strategy for Gillibrand to go after de Blasio,
right?
Because, you know, they're sort of in a symbiotic relationship in certain respects. I know that she is the senator and he is the mayor of the city of New York, but I would just like to remind everyone, the mayor of the city of New York controls half the population of New York City.
Sure.
Like half of her state lives in his city.
Yeah.
So it's not like he's the mayor of a city with 8 million people in it. He's not the mayor of like some tiny town in upstate New York.
Right.
And so...
Yeah.
I was sort of like, oh, this is like a fascinating, slightly self-destructive choice.
Yeah.
But she's desperate right now. So she needs to get back into the game. And she was not getting the kind of attention that I think. And in the first debate, she had been really like sort of combative.
Yeah, she was
and
like
I,
making
sure. So I don't know what her strategy was here.
Yeah,
I don't know. But then Biden also got heckled.
Yes. With 3 million deportations.
Yeah. Talking about the Obama deportation.
Yes. And that then came up while they were talking about immigration, because de Blasio basically pestered Joe and was like, did you ever tell Obama to stop these deportations?
Right.
And he wouldn't give a straight answer. And then Cory Booker basically like came for him. He was like, what'd he say? He said, Mr. Vice President, you can't have it both ways. You invoke President Obama more than anybody in this campaign. You can't do it when it's convenient and then dodge it when it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The exciting political audience action at that debate was more top notch than the first debate
for sure.
If you're wondering which debate had better audiences, it was definitely the second one. But so in any case, Gillibrand, I can't tell if she's gonna make the next debates, but I do have
a thought about her
that I wanted to share while we're
Please
on the topic.
Share.
She did have the biggest, statment of the night.
Yeah.
but I have now, she was the lead sponsor on the VCF bill. Yeah. So we worked with her office on the Senate side to get that passed. And she was, once again, delivered an outstandingly unified vote for us that shows me that she is like probably the secret, like one of the best whippers in the Senate. Yeah. Schumer also was on this bill. It's his state too. Like, obviously he is good at that as well. That's why he's in that position. Yeah. But she has consistently shown that she can deliver votes and with impunity, basically.
Sure.
The Senate vote was 97-2. It means that they were forced to go on the record for the vote. It means that Rand Paul and Mike Lee were the two that voted against it, and it was because their dumb amendments wouldn't pass. Were trying to cast a vote to talk about costs and savings and whatever.
Right.
But it meant that people like Ted Cruz had to walk in and vote against some of their colleagues on a spending bill. And they did it.
Yeah.
Like, that's what... And Gillibrand was just sitting there watching the votes come in, just, like, staring people down, like, nobody's business. But in the aftermath of all of this, I did note what I have often noted with her, which is that she is not a warm person. And so because of that, part of what makes her so effective
so
is she's
good.
Fearless.
Right, yeah, of course. Right.
She doesn't care if you like her in the Senate. She will get your vote somehow, whether or not whether or not you feel fuzzy about her after. But it does make going to family barbecues in Iowa a slightly more difficult thing. So I was sort of like, okay, I see where there's going to be an enthusiasm gap because in the states where every resident has to personally meet you, she's not going to be able to project the kind of warmth that some of these other operators are.
Yeah.
And that could be why she's why she's not connecting in the way that I think she expected to. And then there was one Andrew Yang.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, like, you know, so in this immigration section, which was probably Biden's worst, because he also, you know, is one of the only people out there, I think, along with Michael Bennett, who is, you know, continues to think that it should be a crime to cross the border and criminally prosecuted. And
unsurprisingly, the first night had some proponents of that strategy.
Right, exactly. And that's the whole thing that, you know, Joaquin Castro keeps talking about. Yeah. Like, we have to get rid of this law because, like, that's how they're separating families, and Biden sort of, like, won't get there. Anyway, Andrew Yang, at one point, when they were talking about immigration, said, you know, my dad immigrated here, and he was a PhD, and he had, you know, filed a bunch of patents for the United States, and that was a pretty good deal for the United States. And he wasn't trying to say it as though we should only let PhDs. He was just using it as an example to be like, we are a country of immigrants, and, like, this country is better when we have immigrants. And then Joe Biden immediately responded and was like, yeah, if you have a PhD, you should be able to come here and you should be able to have a green card for 7 years or whatever. Right. I can't remember exactly what it was. And at the time I was sort of like, you can't, no, like, that's not it. And then it was Cory Booker who sort of came to the rescue.
Yeah.
And rightfully, he said, that's playing right into what the Republicans want, to pit some immigrants against other immigrants. Some are from shithole countries, and some are from worthy countries. Yeah. And I was Cory Booker is a man who just said shithole on live television. And
the president said it first.
Well, he did, right. But I was like, yes, that's it.
Right, because if you are a person who is coming to save your own life or the life of your family, why should we decide that your life is expendable to us because you don't have a PhD
and
7 patents.
Your life is less important because you're not going to give us a patent once you cross the border.
And we don't know. Maybe you will. Like, that's the, like, we, the idea
is
not...
That's the American fucking dream,
exactly.
Isn't it? That you might come here as nothing and then create a patent.
I'm reading a history of American English right now. The Bill Bryson history. So not like serious linguist's history, but it's fun.
Yeah.
But he does talk about how many, like, eccentric inventors there were in the sort of, like, early American era, where, like, a lot of our founding fathers were, like, also, you know, that's why Thomas Jefferson is, like, such a, and Ben Franklin.
Oh, Ben Franklin, of course. Right,
all of them are, like, really eccentric, sort of, like, pseudo-inventors, or, you know, in the case of Thomas Jefferson, like, sort of pseudo-ideological rebels. And, and at the time, you could sort of be all of these things. Like, everyone was living, like, weird itinerant lives, essentially, because there was no way to connect anyone's present to their past.
Yeah.
And so, but basically it paints the exact picture of what the idea with immigration is, which is, like, maybe you come here and for 40 years you're a wheat farmer and then you invent electricity.
Right.
Or, you know, maybe
right.
Then you do something eccentric and weird, and your weird experiments that you've been tinkering with are, you know, are the first flight or something, you know.
Yeah.
Like that's the idea. So like, yeah. In any case, Biden did not respond to that in the manner in which he one did. Might. And that also, it points to exactly what I've been saying about their healthcare argument. It's the same idea, which is the idea that some people are expendable to their plan.
Right.
And they we shouldn't do what's best for people. We should do what's best for profit and not worry about the human consequences of that.
Right.
And that is sort of what that's saying.
Yeah, it is.
Because frankly, well, I don't care if a bunch of fucking uneducated people have to come here because they're going to be killed in Honduras. Right.
Because the one thing that, you know, people kept saying, or Kamala Harris did to Joe Biden about his plan, was that it was like going to continue to leave 10 million people off of their health insurance.
Right.
And
Doesn't matter.
I was going to say, it similarly to his immigration, sort of like, you know, I mean.
But these build on each other too. Because,
they build on,
you know,
exactly.
Obviously, if you think that it is okay to create a system in which millions of people are forced to essentially come here undocumented because they have nowhere to go.
Right.
And then you won't give them the resources to make the success that immigrants often make if they are given resources, or to at least become sort of contributing parts of society.
Right.
Then, of course, they're not going to be able to contribute in the way that you would hope they would.
Yep.
And also, people are going to die for no reason because you don't provide them healthcare.
Right.
Like, it's just like you have to be willing to commit to the idea that everyone's life has value.
Yes.
If you actually think that.
Right. And you should
think that. And you should think that because it's the right thing to think. In any case, afterwards, though, there were tons of articles about that were basically like exactly like the first debate. This happened in the first debate, too, where everyone was like, listen, it wasn't Biden's best night, but is he still the best choice? Maybe.
Right.
And I like that just keeps happening. Like the New York Times was like replete with op-eds that were sort of like, sure, was Biden great? No. But was he fine? I don't know. He could be the best.
Well, like, and that's what I just, you know, like, look, I'm not going to vote for Biden in the primary. But if Biden, you know, Biden is running. I just think it's so funny because his entire campaign is predicated on the fact that, like, he is the best person to take on Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And, like, I am willing to listen to that as an argument. But
not right now. I don't think he's proving it.
But prove it to me.
Right.
Like, that's the thing. You know what I mean? It's like, how did we decide that that was the case?
He's not even currently the best person to take on a freshman senator from California.
Thank you.
Like,
you know?
Show us that the most masterfully confusing presence in national politics is not too hard for you to maneuver your way around.
Right, exactly. The best thing that I heard anybody say was on CNN on the panel afterwards. It was David Axelrod, and he said something to the effect of, the good news is that if you're Joe Biden, that was probably the best that you could do. The bad news, if you're Joe Biden, is that was probably the best that you could do. And that's totally true, you know? I mean, like, what did he seem like a hapless goon for 3 hours like he did in the first debate? Probably not. But, like, did you... So yes, like, great. Everybody was coming for him, and, like, maybe he spoke in more complete sentences this time around. But, like, is that what we're looking for?
He did have a hilarious gaffe still, because he said something about Joe Biden 30-30 or whatever.
Oh, that's right, at the end.
At the very end. He didn't know what year he's running for
that
president.
You were supposed to be texting.
What social media handles are.
Yeah.
Right, he gave you the wrong number to text. It was,
you
know, a classic Joe Biden.
Yeah.
it's like things were almost going too well, so he had to end on a low note, as usual. But so, in any case, debate three. Chances are that it will only be one debate.
Yeah, it's still, but I almost, it's too bad because I almost wish that like 12 of them would make it and then we would split it into six. Although I'm excited to see all of the front runners on the stage together.
Yes.
So maybe I don't want that, but it's getting to the point where it seems like I think they're at 7 right now and there's a couple other who are going to be close. What I'm really looking for is just like the top 6 to be the only ones who are like up there. But like, that'll happen at some point, and it's, I get that. But like,
it'll be fun until then to have some distractions. Well,
it will. Yes.
While we, and there's apparently there's I had heard that Andrew Yang qualified, but then it turned out that one of his polls was suspect or something.
He's
so now
gonna make
know.
It though, because he's gonna get, he just needs one more poll at 2% and he'll get it.
That, yeah.
He's got a good 2% going for him right now.
Yeah.
The Yang gang
is
a good solid
2% of America.
Right.
The Democratic
electorate. Right.
meanwhile, while all of this was going on, Puerto Rico like overthrew their government.
Hey, great.
So Puerto Rico We were really sad that we couldn't come do last week because we really wanted to report on this story while it was happening because that's our one of our favorite topics.
I know.
But, and you know, it's a colony, so they'll get bitten in the ass at some point in this process. And we have to power through. We have to still believe this was a good thing.
Because it was.
They literally took to the streets and overthrew their fucking governor.
Yeah. And he finally resigned.
So a couple of weeks ago, because I don't think that this scandal broke after our last podcast. We haven't talked about it. So a couple of weeks ago, this like group chat got leaked. That is like was the governor Rosello there, and then also like a bunch of advisors and other high powered people.
Who were saying like really incendiary things.
They were saying like sexist things, misogynistic things. They were saying homophobic things. And notably, and I think this is the thing that turned everyone. They were making fun of the victims of Hurricane Maria. They made light of people's deaths in Hurricane Maria, which, as you know, if you've been listening to this podcast, was a pretty far-reaching and tragic event.
Yes.
And something that people have been living with there for a long time at this point, because think about how long it took them to even get power back. Like, they're not recovered yet from Hurricane Maria.
They're not.
So, just a quick government note. This isn't even like PR 101. This is like PR kindergarten.
Right.
You probably shouldn't mock dead people after you've mismanaged the relief effort of a major crisis.
Correct. Don't be doing that.
In any case, people took to the streets, and there were these massive
hundreds
protests in San Juan. Yeah, like in
and elsewhere too.
And elsewhere, and in other parts of the island, the pictures that we saw were of these huge protests in San Juan, which were like
and in other parts of the world.
Yes,
too.
Right.
I mean, obviously, the ones in Puerto Rico probably had the most effect. Well,
there were sympathy protests all over the place.
Yeah.
But it was literally like the first time in a long time that we have seen something crazy like this happen. Seen people take to the streets.
Right.
And seen the governor resign.
Take notes, America.
Because he resigned.
He did.
Now, did he fuck them over one more time before resigning?
On his way out.
Sure. Yeah, obviously he did that. And he was like a dozen people or something stepped down. Like the whole government basically had to be replaced after this. So like it's been sort of chaotic. And part of the way that he fucked them over while stepping down is so he promised to leave by this Friday. He did. But there were some issues with the qualifications of some of the members of his administration, and because of that, it wasn't clear who was in the constitutional line of succession. So it wasn't sure who was going to be taking over.
Yeah.
So on Friday, before he resigned, what he did was he basically handed the governorship to... He appointed this guy, Pedro Pierluisi, who used to be the Puerto Rico's non-voting rep in Congress. He was for a long time. For like 8 years or something like that. He ran against Rosello in the primaries in 2016 and lost, but he's also been the justice secretary under Rosello's father when he was the governor, because this is a dynasty that we have going on right now in Puerto Rico. And so he appointed him secretary of state in a recess appointment.
Yep.
It didn't get approved by the Senate.
Right.
And so he basically appointed his own successor, even though he is the person being forced to resign after... Yep. Obviously not serving the needs of the Puerto Rican people. And so in naming him Secretary of State, put him in line. And then emailed an announcement from his office saying that this guy would succeed him, Seceding is leaving.
Yes,
succeeding.
That's right.
My tongue got twisted there. And basically the guy got sworn in at the moment that Rosello had to leave office. But because the Senate hasn't voted on him yet, there's sort of like a crisis going on there with, A, the question of whether or not it requires a Senate appointment if it's a recess appointment.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of not clear in the Constitution. It says something along the lines of, in order to become governor, you have to be confirmed by both the House and the Senate, except for the Secretary of State.
Yeah.
But because the Secretary of State was appointed with the knowledge that he was about to become the governor, he was essentially appointing a governor. It's like...
Yeah.
No one really knows.
And he has said that he will only serve until the Senate actually does vote on it. And if they vote no on his nomination, then he will step down.
So and then, that then means that they have the third governor of the week.
Well, That's true.
So people are kind of unsettled by
and
this.
Who picks that?
Yeah. Well, it's the same. It's another political appointee.
Yeah.
You know, appointee. So people not thrilled with this kind of maneuvering. And also... The real issue is that the president of the Senate is like the main rival of Rosello.
Oh boy!
Like he's other party kind of like big shot, and I think he wanted to be named, and so he's about to make it very difficult
For this guy.
Yes, but also Pierluisi's worked for the firm that represented the Federal Control Board that was overseeing Puerto Rico's finances and promoting austerity measures. So people didn't really notice that until he had already been appointed, but now they're kind of like, wait a minute.
Wait, we don't want
this
guy
is in league with the people that are fucking over our economy. And he says he's against the austerity measures, but he is a public-private partnership guy, but he's in favor of privatizing the power utility there. And we know they've had issues with the power utility there, you know, all over the place. But I don't think on the progressive side that people are thinking that it should be privatized. They're thinking that it should be taken under the control of a functional board.
Right, exactly.
So there's some worries about what all of this means, but let's focus on the positive.
Yes.
The people of Puerto Rico
showed
that if you take to the streets and demand something from your government, that sometimes you can make something happen.
That's right.
And that seems like a lesson we could all be inspired by in this moment.
We really
could
be.
Because we need it.
Yes.
And I would actually say that if you are inspired by this in this moment,
yes.
It is recess right now for Congress, which means they are probably doing town halls in your district. And I went to one in upstate New York with Antonio Delgado, and he did not expect a rural district, part of his district like that, to come out for impeachment the way that they did. But the room was not with him on that. He has not come out for impeachment. The room was very pro-impeachment. The room, he got asked multiple questions about it. And he got asked, you know, just like a week later in another rural town hall, he got the same thing happen. So if you are someone who wants to see something happen, ask these people to come out in favor of an impeachment inquiry.
Right? Exactly. Because more than 50% of Democrats
are now in favor.
Finally there.
It's time to get there. So you
the rest
could,
of
this
there.
Is your opportunity to actually like do something without having to like go to Washington and like make a bunch of phone calls.
Yeah.
You could go to a town hall, meet your representative, and actually say what you want to say to them.
Yeah.
So
do it.
If Puerto Rico has inspired you to do anything, let it be to go
let
to your local
that.
Town hall, which will be boring, and I'm sorry about it.
Yep.
But you should do it. Meanwhile, we have some more cabinet drama.
Yes.
The National Intelligence Director. And listen, they're not... The fact that the Trump administration has anyone to direct national intelligence with the word direct and intelligence right there in the title is confusing to all of us.
It is.
But Dan Coats was like a real person at least.
Yes.
One of the last real people around.
Right.
And he...
So when he resigned...
Quote unquote resigned.
Yeah.
As you often do in the Trump administration.
It was time to get a non-real person in.
That's right. They had to...
Yes.
So they went to the first non-real person they could find.
Right. And
was John Ratcliffe.
From the great state of Texas.
That's right.
Which is not where you would look for someone necessarily as someone to run anything that has the word intelligence in it.
His audition tape was him grilling Mueller at the Mueller hearing a week and a half ago.
Sure.
You know what? We haven't brought you a story about that, but it's because nothing really happened.
right.
But so in any case, but people did notice, they were like, who is this guy?
Yeah.
Who is like really into the, and like that was a boring hearing where Mueller was like half asleep the whole time.
Yeah.
And like this guy went to town. So he got announced as Trump's pick, but it only has lasted 5 days. He's already taken himself out of the running.
Because everyone was like, no.
Yeah. Well, first of all, he has no experience and he's not qualified. But second of all, you know, he couldn't handle the scrutiny of the press turning on him and all of his GOP colleagues being like, I mean, I guess he's okay.
Since when did the Republicans in the Senate, and maybe this is a change that we should, you know, applaud, even though it's a small change, but like, since when did Republicans decide that they cared about whether Trump's cabinet choices were qualified for the job that he was appointing them
to? I mean, it's a curious change, but it's a good one,
at least. It's a good one,
He can't find anyone to fill it is part of the problem.
Sure.
Devin Nunes said no.
Oh, God.
And this is not a man who's filled with a lot of national intelligence or general intelligence. But it looks like now Trump is pretending like it was always his intention to have the number two at the at the agency take over Sue Gordon on an acting basis. So now he's like, I've always wanted Sue Gordon to be the acting. So we're going to have yet another acting director at yet another agency. We don't have any regular people running things right now.
Right.
It's just like interim. It's like the whole government is just interim appointees.
Right.
And we are like,
yikes.
The Trump administration already knows. So, I mean, maybe it's helpful because it means that people who are actually from the administration side of that agency are running it as opposed to just like complete randos. But maybe it's also not great because it seems like you would want someone to be doing an important job, like running a federal agency. I don't know. I'm crazy. Whatever. What
Who
am
knows?
I saying?
Who knows?
Meanwhile, Donald Trump is in a Twitter feud, a one-sided Twitter feud with Elijah Cummings. Well, Elijah Cummings is in a one-sided impeachment feud with Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is in a one-sided Baltimore-related Twitter feud
right.
with Elijah Cummings.
Yeah. Because Elijah Cummings, his committee, is investigating.
Yeah, Trump as they
the
should
Trump,
be.
And the Trump family.
Right. So instead of addressing that concern, Trump tweeted, Cummings District is a disgusting rat and rodent infested mess. If he spent more time in Baltimore, maybe he could help clean up this very dangerous and filthy place.
Okay.
First of all, Donald Trump is the president in Baltimore, too.
I mean,
everyone at every level here has a responsibility towards Baltimore.
Right.
Second of all, it was confusing to everyone that he chose this line of attack, because Baltimore's actually, like, gotten pretty nice.
Sure.
So Fox News started posting pictures of random places in Baltimore with unkempt yards and things like that, or like a rat in Baltimore. But like these all instead looked like places that could be in any city and were likely in your front yard too, because there's fucking homeless people living everywhere all over every city in America because there's no homes.
Right.
No one can afford to live anywhere.
Right.
So instead of making the point that Baltimore is a shithole, everyone was like, maybe Beverly Hills is a shithole. Like, right. You know, like it didn't make his point anyway. But it was an interesting thing for him to say as someone who is, as I said, the president in Baltimore, too.
Right.
Because it's almost like he doesn't think he has any responsibility towards Baltimore, which is interesting, especially because his son-in-law is one of the biggest landlords in Baltimore and a noted slumlord who is being investigated by the city.
Yeah.
So one person who could work to address the rat and rodent problem in Baltimore would be its biggest landlord.
Yes, correct.
But apparently the fact that he is a person who works in the White House and a member of the Trump family is not enough to think that to give Trump the idea that maybe he has responsibilities beyond just, you know, Elijah Cummings.
Meanwhile, Elijah Cummings is handling this like, you know, the graceful human being that he is.
Could not give two fucks about Donald Trump's opinion of his district.
Right. Because he's spoke about it for the first time, like, this Saturday and, like, was talking about impeachment and was, like, talking about how he wanted to be fair in impeachment. And he's one of the people that you should go and find a town hall in Baltimore,
for. He hasn't come out in favor
he's
yet.
He's not there.
Yeah.
He's with Pelosi on this. So, if you live in one of the rat-infested areas of Baltimore, go
Feel
see
free
Elijah
to
Cummings.
Give him a call about impeachment.
No, but I mean, you know, he also said something, he said, when I hear criticism by anybody about my city, what bothers me most is we have a situation where folks are stepping on the foot on the hope of our children. I don't know what I would have done if I had people in high places when I was a little boy telling me what I couldn't do. I mean, like, these are the types of, like, thoughtful responses that Elijah Cummings is giving, which is, like, you know, just makes him seem like the adult in the room, which I'm sure was his plan, obviously.
Well,
but
obviously,
he always was anyway.
I was going to say, already is the adult in the room.
I was
going
to say, he didn't have to do much to prove that. But, like,
no.
I appreciate his sort of response to this being what it was, as much as I would just like him
to
be like,
what are you supposed to do when the president... And this you know, I know Trump's language is coarser than when this has happened in the past, so I recognize that this is a more specific and kind of ridiculous situation.
Yeah.
But there were plenty of there have been plenty of eras where urban areas have been demonized by sitting presidents who have made it seem like it's somehow not their responsibility.
They're not always Republicans either.
No, exactly. This is a strategy that we have seen before.
Yeah. And he's been around a while too, so he's seen this movie before also.
Exactly. I was going to say this is, you know, Baltimore is a city that has struggled. And so he is not someone who doesn't know that a lot of that, what was essentially also racial animus that was directed towards cities in the 80s and the 70s and the 60s even,
90s.
That the 90s,
I mean,
right, I forgot about the 90s, which is our era, the era where we remember it happening.
It was going on then, too.
Right.
Yeah, right.
But I mean, like, he's not someone who has not been around to see this movie before, but it is sort of like a more ironic movie because... You know, Donald Trump has for a long time been reusing those same tropes that don't really apply to cities in the same way.
Right.
You know, cities have gotten safer. They're very expensive. So a lot of the problems that Trump references as city problems, the problems with drugs, those are rural problems right now. Those are not city problems.
Totally.
You know, like problems with crime, those are often suburban problems at this point because they're, you know.
Yeah, rich white kids.
It's rich white kids. And also it's the fact that suburbs have started to struggle because the cost of living in cities is so high that communities where people were struggling are being pushed out into the suburbs.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the, you know, the gang violence issues such that we have, a lot of those are being pushed out into the suburbs. So, like, I get that you know, he's sort of like harping on the wrong thing in the first place. But the language he's using is also just like straight out of a horror movie from 1972.
Right.
Like it's not.
Yeah, totally.
He's like playing Nixon's movie.
Yeah.
Which he is.
Yeah, that's
in many ways. Right. You know. But in any case, that is all we pulled for today. So that's all we have.
That's it.
I know a lot happened, but it's just okay. Like, what could we do?
Yeah. You
know.
We knew we were going to talk about the debates for an hour.
Yeah.
So
and we fit other stuff in where we could.
Right.
We are going to the Iowa State Fair.
We are. We have our
booked tickets.
We have
it is
a
happening.
Place to stay.
That's right. So it's we are making our podcast dreams come true.
Uh-huh. We're going to take our little recorder with us.
That's right. Look for some trouble while we're there.
That's right.
And so
start some trouble while we're there, potentially.
Hopefully. So we'll be here next weekend.
Yeah.
To report on whatever happens this week. Yeah. But after that, we are going to be late, but excited.
Yeah. And find us on social media because we'll be posting like all the world's pictures from
that's
the
right. We are at Braintrust Live everywhere.
Yeah.
So find us there and we will talk to you next week.
Bye.